With less than a week until the first round of Jacksonville city elections, four candidates are in the running to be the next mayor. Just ahead, we talk to one of them. City Councilman Bill Bishop is here. Good morning, live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jessica Palumbo, sitting in for Melissa Ross, who's on vacation. First Coast Connect is always live on the radio, and now catch our daily podcast on iTunes. And just ahead, we'll take your calls for mayoral candidate Bill Bishop. That number is 549-2937. Then we'll hear from people working to start a museum all about Jacksonville. Later, a volunteer highway rescuer tells us how to avoid getting stranded by a breakdown on your spring break travels. And we're excited to welcome the first round winner of WJCT's artist competition, The Square. All of that's coming up this hour, but first this morning, four candidates are in the running to be Jacksonville mayor. One of them is Republican City Councilman Bill Bishop, and he's here in studio this morning. Bill Bishop, welcome to First Coast Connect.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
To our listeners, what are your questions for Mr. Bishop? That number again is 549-2937, or go to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email us, or tweet me at Jessica Pub Radio. That's Jessica, P-U-B, Radio. And the phone lines are already lighting up. We have lots of questions coming in on Facebook. Let's start out with one from Facebook. Andrew asks, Mr. Bishop, are you only running to pull votes from Mayor Brown?
No, I'm running to win. That's why I'm doing it.
All right. A recent UNF poll shows voters' number one issue is crime. What would you do as mayor to fight violent crime in Jacksonville?
Well, the most important thing to fighting violent crime is economic development. Jobs. When people have jobs, crime goes down. That's just a fact. When people don't have jobs, crime goes up. When people can't support themselves, bad things happen. With respect to the police side of things, we have to get this pension problem under control. We're spending far too much money out of our budget on pension payments, which is robbing us of resources for everything else, including hiring lost officers, let alone new ones.
The UNF poll showed you trailing far behind Mayor Alvin Brown and behind Republican Lenny Curry. A day later, the Florida Times Union endorsed you to be the mayor. Do you think that has helped you?
Oh, I think it has. I think that poll now is about a month old. A lot of things have happened in that time. And I think the gap is a whole lot closer than people think it is.
Back in January, the Duval County court clerk stopped all courthouse weddings after gay marriage became legal in Florida. David on Facebook asks, if elected, will you try to restore weddings at the courthouse here?
Well, the short answer to that is yes. What I understand Clerk Fussell's reasons for doing what he did, because the clerk is not required to perform marriage ceremonies, he doesn't have to do it, neither do his employees. But the space was constructed by tax dollars paid for by everybody. My argument is just open the space up and let people who are legally entitled to marry use the space, bring their own officiator. That doesn't put anybody in any odd position, I would think.
Okay. Adam on Facebook says, I believe Councilmember Bishop has stated he prefers increasing the sales tax as a method to balance the budget. Adam asks, I was wondering if he had looked at how a sales tax would affect the less fortunate versus increasing property taxes.
I think the sales tax model is much more equitable. It crosses all across. The more you buy, the more you pay. Food and medicine are exempt from sales tax anyway, which in the lower income brackets is a predominant expense each month. And so everybody, also what people forget is everybody pays property tax, whether you own property or not. If you rent, you pay property tax as a part of your rent. Property owners don't pay it out of the goodness of their heart. It's a business expense. It gets buried in the cost.
Going to another Facebook question, Melissa on Facebook asks, what do you plan to do to save Arlington with businesses fleeing every day?
A couple of things I think will bring Arlington back. Number one is the CRA that's being talked about to be put in place along Merrill Road that Jacksonville University is championing. One of the things that Arlington has not that suffered from Arlington's demise, if you will, not demise, but downfall over the years is a very complicated process, and it's going to take a while to bring it back. What it needs is a champion, and President Tim Kost is fulfilling that role because JU has a big investment in that area. They will, in a sense, become that squeaky wheel to create the community rallying cry, if you will, to bring back Arlington. Downtown redevelopment is also going to help Arlington because it's very close. Arlington has a housing stock that is in good shape. It is very affordable, and it's a great place for starter homes for people who are looking to be close to a revitalized urban core. So I think as downtown goes, Arlington will go also. Again, general economic development in the city, which will allow us to restore our law enforcement facilities, also will make a difference because Arlington suffers from a lot of crime in certain areas. And generally, just providing neighborhoods the tools to look out for themselves. A neighborhood that takes ownership of itself is far more successful than ones that don't.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Jacksonville mayoral candidate Bill Bishop. The number to call is 549-2937 with your questions. And now we'll go to the phones. Mike is on the line from Bay Meadows. Mike, you are live with Bill Bishop.
Man, I tell you, it's strange to hear what's the reason coming from a politician. But the nature of my call is I do support you, Mr. Bishop, and I appreciate your serviceability across the board, across party lines. I'm duly licensed as a general contractor and an architect. And I can tell you now that the economy has rebounded, there's nothing worse than realizing that the city has hundreds of thousands of building permits that come through review, that go through an onerous process. And we understand why the city has a regulation. But the truth of the matter is the system is broken down there, and it's nobody's fault. But Mr. Bishop, you can vouch for this. When a guy goes out there for a permit, he's got a signed and sealed set of drawings from an architect or GC with liability insurance and regulation through the state board of professional regulation. And the biggest issue is if the bank tells a guy he can't pull the permit, the city hasn't collected a fee for the permit. It's hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars that could be used in tax coffers to collect. And what my simple proposal to you, Mr. Bishop, is when a contractor or a developer comes down there for a permit, take the money and swipe his card then. If he builds the building or not, it's irrelevant. Why the city don't take that money and give that guy even a provisional permit to let him move forward with his banking, underwriting, or whatever. If the project never goes through, the city is taking his money. He didn't build it. Who cares? But what it's done is it's got the wheels turning and got needless regulation out of the way so the guy can go to his bank or to his developer or to his investor and say, hey, we applied for the permit. We licensed guys. We paid the fees. If it blows up, if the deal never goes through, the city has collected already. You can't unreview a drawing.
Thank you, Mike. Mike, we have lots of other callers to get to. Bill Bishop, would you like to respond?
Mike, that you hit a big hot button of mine. The city's development process and permitting process has just gotten out of control. I used to think that South Florida was bad, but we're almost as bad at this point. It's not that difficult to fix this stuff. It's just basic management. The thing has gotten out of control because leadership is lost in that whole arena. And there's many, many ways that we can make that system far more user-friendly, far more faster to process than we have time to talk about today. But Mike, you're absolutely right. The process is broken, and that's obviously one of the first things I got to fix. And it's really not going to be that tough to do.
All right, going now to Sarah in downtown. Sarah, you're live on the air.
Yes, Mr. Bishop, as City Council President, you appointed only Caucasian council members to committee chairs. What's your reasoning for the lack of diversity in your appointment? Because in the debate, you said you only regretted it because you didn't realize you're going to be running for mayor.
Well, what I said was, if I had realized I was going to be running for mayor and that I realized that there were people that would take something and turn it into something that it was not, there were people that tried to turn that into a racial division issue, and that had nothing to do with it. I put people in place that I felt were appropriate at the time to run committees, just like every council president has done in the past and will always do in the future. And there was no racial animus there at all. There are certain people that tried to turn it into that, and it just simply wasn't there. So when I said I would have done it differently, of course, because people turn things into stuff that it isn't, and That was, I guess, that was an eye-opening experience from a personal standpoint when somebody tries to tar you with something that's not there. There's certain ways to deal with it.
Thanks for the question, Sarah. A related question from Facebook. Cam asks, if elected, will your appointments be the best person for the job, or will they be political so that you don't get targeted as a racist, a sexist, homophobic, or whatever?
Oh, Lord. Listen, I want the best people to work for the city. I think everybody wants the best people to work for the city. Jacksonville is an extremely diverse community. It's an extremely international community, more than people realize. And I mean, my commitment has always been, I want the best people to do the job, whoever they are and wherever they come from.
Now we're going to Robert in Riverside. Robert, you're on.
Hi there. Bill Bishop, speaking of calling something it isn't, recently you've been endorsed by some LGBTQ groups, but, I'm wondering, how is it that you can consider yourself an advocate for those rights when in your March 3rd Times Union profile, you clearly came out saying that you do not support gay marriage? And secondarily, you, in 2012, were a key lieutenant in Herman Cain's campaign here in Florida. You called it a marketing gig, but my question is what was it a marketing gig for? Other Tea Party conservatives? Again, I don't understand how you can call yourself that kind of an advocate when you're against gay marriage and you've worked for someone like Herman Cain.
Thanks for the question, Robert.
All right. First of all, I did not work for Herman Cain. I supported Herman Cain because I believed at the time he was the only candidate, regardless of party, that was talking about our dysfunctional federal tax system and the great need for it to be reformed, and what it is doing is it is stifling innovation and it is stifling resources to our community, and it's a very inequitable tax code. I still believe that to this day. He was right about that. With respect to gay marriage, I don't believe in it, but I've been very clear about that. But that doesn't mean that there should not be gay rights with respect to where you live, where you work, just general integration into the community. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that, and it ought to happen. Utah is a great example of that. They just passed a very comprehensive LGBT rights bill in the state. And if they can do it, we can certainly do it here as well.
Why draw the line at marriage?
There is 5,000 years of cultural and religious history behind what marriage stands for. There's a whole lot more to that than whether or not you make decisions about where people live, where they can work, public accommodations, those sorts of things. And we don't, unfortunately, have a whole lot of time this morning to go into that whole issue there. But once you start changing the definition of marriage, where do you draw the line? And I'll just leave that at that, and people can think about that however they want to.
All right, going to Hunter, calling from near downtown. Hunter, what's your question for Bill Bishop?
Good morning, Councilman. You've advocated for a half-cent sales tax. Have you actually sat down with the Senate President and the Speaker of the House to get their support on that?
I have not personally at this point, no. The legislature has been very clear that they are not inclined to want to vote for, at least our delegation has, for any new sales tax. The most likely prospect for that is what's called the fire services tax, which exists on the books today. It's somewhat convoluted, but we can do it, provided the citizens of Jacksonville vote for it.
Thank you for the question, Hunter. We now go to Jay in Lakewood. Jay, you're on the air.
Good morning. First of all, I'd like to thank you, Mr. Bishop, for running against the establishment politicians who refuse to answer any of the questions like you're doing here. I really do appreciate that.
Well, thank you.
It's candidates like yourself who actually come out and are willing to face the heat that make me proud to be an American. You don't get that these days.
What's your question, Jay?
My big question for you is, what is your plan for the proposed master development of the shipyards? Who do you see as the stakeholders who should be involved in the master planning process?
Thanks for the question.
Well, there's a lot of stakeholders in that. I think obviously number one is the city government as the owner of the property, which means the mayor and the city council. There's a number of advocacy groups with respect to downtown that are stakeholders. You've got Downtown Vision. You've got a variety of business groups. The Chamber has an interest in it. Basically, everybody in Jacksonville has an interest in that site because it's such a prominent site. And since downtown redevelopment and downtown itself impacts everything about this city, everybody has a stake in it.
Now, during the debate and during this show, a lot of questions have focused on the downtown area. But as you know, Jacksonville is a lot bigger than downtown. So can you name one specific other area of town you see the need for a change and what you would like to make that change?
Well, the biggest area that needs change is the northwest section of Jacksonville, which is the center of the highest rate of unemployment and violent crime in the city. It's an area of the city that has been promised things going back over 45 years prior to consolidation to vote for it, and they've basically been left out of everything. All their promises have been made for decades that have never come true. And so as a result, we have a divided city right now. We have, there's something like, I don't know what the level of black unemployment in the area is, something over 30%. It's just unconscionable that that kind of thing has to happen. What I want to see happen there is the same concerted effort used to develop the south side of the river back in the 80s and 90s. I want to use that same level of effort in northwest Jacksonville to bring business to that area. We have to bring educational opportunities to the people there that don't have college degrees. We have to enhance public transportation in an area for people that can't afford cars so that they can get to work on a predictable basis so they can get employed. These little steps have to take place in order to transform the area.
How do you attract businesses to that area?
You start by going after businesses that are natural fits for the assets that the community has right now. The port, the airport, there's a lot of rail traffic, there's a lot of industry in that area. And like business tends to, there's a reason those kinds of businesses are there. The logistics transportation network for that kind of stuff is there. We can go after those kind of businesses because we have an asset to sell. That's the starting point. The other parts that we also need to do is neighborhood revitalization. Again, like the same issues we talked about in Arlington apply in northwest Jacksonville. You've got neighborhoods that basically don't understand how to work the system, if you will. We need to teach them how to look out for themselves. When they do that, you create champions in those neighborhoods. You take residents to take ownership of those neighborhoods. They can then by themselves, in conjunction with law enforcement, drive out crime. It happens. Every single neighborhood that's been revitalized goes through that model. We can do this there too.
All right. Going to another area of town, the South Side. Jacob is on the phone calling from the South Side. Jacob, what's your question?
Good morning. My question for Mr. Bishop is, I've seen the ads that Mayor Brown is running claiming responsibility for the decrease in unemployment. Mr. Bishop, do you agree that Mayor Brown's responsible for this? And if not, what is responsible for our improved economy?
Thanks, Jacob, for the question.
Well, I think just the general economic recovery as low as it is in the country is responsible for that. The city, I can tell you, hasn't done very little proactively to recruit anything. In fact, there's examples of where the mayor's team dropped the ball, and I actually came back to the rescue a couple of times when I was council president. But it's basically the general economic recovery in the nation. When you talk about 36,000 jobs in a city of almost 1 million people, that's really not very much.
All right, going now to Robert. Robert in Jacks Beach, what's your question for Bill Bishop?
Yes, thank you. Mr. Bishop, I noticed when you were speaking with a previous caller, Mike, you mentioned leadership, and it's kind of been shown throughout your points that you've mentioned. But in the last debate, you mentioned your largest accomplishment was you referred to a noise ordinance in Met Park in a city with such serious and diverse issues. As council president, what have you really done, and why didn't you more directly engage, for instance, pension reform?
That's a real good question because there's a big misunderstanding out there about how the pension system works. City council, and I'm a council member, I'm not the mayor. City Council is not permitted to involve themselves in the pension system. Florida law requires that all pension issues and all collective bargaining issues are between, in our case, the mayor and the unions. The City Council's sole job is to vote something up or down. We're not allowed to become a partner in the negotiation process, by which one can argue this current method we're going through technically doesn't meet the requirements of the law because we are, in a sense, negotiating a deal, which we're really not supposed to do. And so no council ever inserts themselves into the pension issue because we're simply not allowed to do it.
Thanks for the call, Robert. Now going to Alex in Lakewood. Alex, what is your question?
Well, I mean, very interesting listening to Mr. Bishop talking about his feelings about, you know, gay marriage. This may sound like beating a dead horse, but I mean, what is he planning to do when the issue of passing the civil rights ordinance comes up again under his term?
Thank you for the question, Alex. And of course, that expanded human rights ordinance would include protections for gay and transgendered people in Jacksonville.
I've said from the beginning that I support it.
Okay. He supports it. And Joe is on the line now. Joe, what is your question? Joe, are you there? Okay, moving on to Judy. Judy calling from Murray Hill. What is your question?
Yes, our libraries are still closed on Mondays, and most of them are closed on Sundays. I feel like this is totally unacceptable. What would you do to change this?
Thanks for the question, Judy.
Good question, Judy. I want, as soon as we as practically possible, I want to restore full funding to the library system. Keep in mind, again, as we said at the very beginning, the single biggest issue that's driving our train right now is this underfunded pension problem. We are spending far too much money on that, and consequently, with our existing revenue stream, we don't have enough income to restore all of the services that we've cut over the last 4 years. And the only way that I can possibly see to do that is we have to have more money in the system, which at some point gets back to the issue of whether we do a property tax or a sales tax increase or something. Because without it, we either need more money or we have to decide what we're willing to live without. And at the moment, I don't think this community is willing to live without these basic services that we expect to have in our community.
Now, on this program last week, one of our commenters who watched the debate said that you tend to get very technical when you're asked questions about policy. Do you think that your level of detail hurts you when you're talking to voters?
I've had that comment made to me several times, and it may very well in a sense, but at one level, I think people are smarter than we give them credit for. I think people understand this stuff. And for so often, most people that run for political office, I get sick and tired of hearing pandering statements that don't tell me anything. Advertisements that say I'm gonna promise you the moon and they don't deliver. And I think many politicians do it to themselves because how do you expect anybody to ever understand anything if you don't tell them what's going on?
All right, going back to the phone, Joe, I believe got cut off and he's calling back. Joe, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning. What is your
First
question?
Thing I'd like to say is go Osprey.
Swoop.
But what I really want to talk about is I heard Mr. Bishop talking about jobs for Jacksonville and bringing jobs to Jacksonville. And I'd like to ask you, we just built a $500 million courthouse that has very few Jacksonville workers or taxpayers were part of construction. And right now in the state legislature, there are bills that are going through the legislature to stop local communities from requiring local people to be working on their jobs. And I'd like to know what his position is concerning these types of laws. And does he believe that Jacksonville should be able to put an ordinance in that says if we're going to spend our taxpayer dollars on projects that our taxpayers should be able to work on?
All right. Thank you for the question, Joe.
That is a very complicated subject. Generally speaking, I believe that local communities should have the ability to control their local destiny, and I believe that there is a point at which local people should benefit from local tax dollars spent. The other side of that whole thing is the city of Jacksonville is not large enough to support the entire construction industry of the city of Jacksonville. If that were the case over the last 4 years, everybody would be out of business because there wasn't anything going on. We had this discussion probably 5 or 6 years ago in council at the height of the recession. Should we put in stronger local preference construction laws? the argument that I supported at the time was, no, we should not, because if we start doing that here, that we say we're only going to do business with people that are businesses in Jacksonville, surrounding counties are going to start doing the same thing. And then our people that work here in Jacksonville who do work today in other counties will be shut out of those markets. And you start going down this trade war effort, and that's doesn't do anybody any good. And if anybody that studies history, that was one of the biggest causes of the Great Depression, was the Smoot-Hawley Act that went around the world, that basically every country shut their doors, and we simply shut down world commerce. We don't want to do that to our businesses here who work all over the state.
Well, we are out of time to take your questions. Thank you so much to all of our callers, and thank you, Bill Bishop, for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me this morning.
Much more still ahead. Later in the hour, we'll hear the song that won the most votes in WJCT's first ever local artist contest, The Square. But up next, the stories of Jacksonville are being collected for a new local history museum. That's after this.
Join WJCT and Sid the Science Kid at Mosh for Nano Days, the biggest event for the smallest science. Meet Sid. Check out his newest Sid the Science Kid Encyclopedia of Discovery DVD and explore nanoscience through hands-on activities. Saturday, March 28th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Learn more at themosh.org.
Funding for this event was provided in part by N-Circle Entertainment.
Do you remember your first time?
My first time? First time of what?
It's a little uncomfortable. Should I talk about it now?
Your first time listening to NPR's Morning Edition, that is.
I was 6 years old riding around in my parents' car, and I was like, what is this stuff? And I just kept listening.
No matter how many times you've listened, listen again tomorrow to Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings beginning at 5 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
The Florida legislature is in session, and Capitol Report is your nightly connection to what's happening in Tallahassee as lawmakers debate and decide issues that affect all Floridians, such as expanding health care and gambling, protecting the state's water resources, private versus public schools, and prison reform. Hear Capitol Report each weeknight during the legislative session on this Florida public radio station.
That's Tuesday through Friday nights at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
WJCT invites you to attend the One Jacks Forum in its Civil Discourse Series, When Race and Authority Come Face to Face. Moderated by UNF President John Delaney, featured members of the panel will be Sheriff John Rutherford and EWC President Nat Glover, Monday, March 23rd at 7 p.m. in the University Center on the UNF campus. The forum is free and open to the public, but a ticket is required. www.unf.edu/onejacks.
Welcome back to First Coast Connect on 89.9. A group of volunteers is getting ready to open the first of several planned museum exhibits all about Jacksonville. Sherry J. Hill is one of them. She joins us now. Welcome to First Coast Connect.
I am so excited to be here. Thank you.
Excited to have you here. So you are with the Jacksonville Museum and Cultural Center. What is that?
Well, it's actually a group of volunteers that are coming together to assemble exhibits out of the community. Community has proposed certain topics that they want to see exhibits for, and we are sort of facilitating that. It's sort of a crowdfunding, crowdsourcing museum, starting with the exhibits and then working from there forward.
Okay, so I understand you're opening the first exhibit this Friday, right?
We have a mock-up for the first exhibit. It's okay. Taken a lot of energy to get to that point. We're going to do a public art and gardens display that will feature an interactive map of all of the public art and interesting details and interesting spots that we have. Some of it doesn't really qualify as art.
Like what?
Like the dinosaur on Beach Boulevard, which I'm really fond of. He doesn't really qualify, but he's going to be definitely on the map as well.
Okay, so how does the interactive part work?
It's similar to some of the things that other cities have done. Seattle has a great map where it's a big 55-inch touchscreen, and people can look by neighborhood and pick out pieces of art that they're interested in.
Cool.
Local photographers are all donating their time to go out and actually capture these images. And we are going to different municipalities and getting details about who put them there, why they're there, what the story is behind them, some of the funnier things that people, some of the nicknames and, you know, interesting details about our art. And the Cultural Council actually supplied us with the list. They have a huge stake in maintaining our public art here. They mm-hmm. have a nice collection, and they gave us details for all of their collection as well. So
oh, wow.
That's super helpful.
So the exhibit that's opening this week, or where is that? What will people see when they go there?
We are participating in OneSpark. It's a way for us to connect with people on a larger scale. And right now we're in the Wells Fargo building in the Northwest Gallery. And that's where the mock-up will be. And after that, we have a whole list of exhibits that we're going to roll out. Mm-hmm. But this is our first, and the template for the rest of the pieces that we're going to show. And it's super exciting. I mean, the community is really coming out and really supporting what we're doing. The other interesting, unique thing about this is that we're hoping to have a curatorial board that is all of the other entities, all of the other museums, the zoo, all of the cultural, you know, pillars of the landscape are going to come in and keep their eyes on us and help guide us and steer us, because I am no historian and they are. They're doing the hard work. They're archiving and preserving all of our history. And they have all of the pieces. We're just assembling them.
Okay, so the space you have in the Wells Fargo building, is that starting this Friday?
Yes, we're there now. We're using that as a meeting space and using it to sort of build one exhibit at a time. Mm-hmm. And we have our eye on a building, but it's a long way off until we get to that point. But yes, it's in the northwest corner of the Wells Fargo building on Laura Street and Bay, mm-hmm. and that's where we will be for OneSpark as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I understand you have another project going on in addition to the public art map concurrently. What is that?
I don't know.
About recordings?
Oh, the Jack's Life. I was like, oh my gosh, uh-huh. We have so many things going on. We are taking a note from StoryCorps. There are so many amazing stories that I just found out there's a train buried underneath the Wells Fargo building. I know.
It's buried underneath?
That's what I've been told. I have to go back and research that, but I've been told by some of the people who work in the Wells Fargo building that there's a train buried underneath the corner of the building.
Okay.
So these are things that it's like folklore. To find a place where you can sort of assemble all of these stories and make it interesting. And so, yeah. But the Jack's Life will be a recorded session of people coming in. They can bring artifacts if they want, or they can just come in and tell stories about their life, their experience, and what it means to live here.
Will you be doing that during OneSpark as well?
We hope to have some recordings to show during OneSpark, and then we will be signing up and lining up people so that we can, you know, continue to gather those stories and organize that.
Well, thank you so much. Sherry J. Hill is here with the Jacksonville Museum and Cultural Center. You can catch them at OneSpark in the Wells Fargo building. Sherry, thank you for being here this morning.
Thank you so much.
And still ahead, the winner of the first round of the Square Arts Contest, James English, is here. But up next, how to get out of a jam when you break down on the road. That's after this.
Congratulations to writer James English, winner of the first quarter of The Square. Now it's your chance to show off your art, whether it's music, visual art, sculpture, poetry, and more. Go to wjct.org/The Square, check out the amazing local talent, and submit your work now.
When a mama and daddy moved into the house across the street.
Welcome back to First Coast Connect. I'm Jessica Palumbo, in for Melissa Ross. With Northeast Florida's public schools and universities on spring break this week, many drivers may be planning road trips. My next guest is a man who has helped thousands of drivers who run into unexpected trouble on the road as a hobby. Walt Brinker is the author of A Guide for Avoiding Breakdowns, and if one does happen to you, how to avoid becoming stranded because of it. The book is called Roadside Survival: Low-Tech Solutions to Automobile Breakdowns. Walt, welcome to First Coast Connect.
Hello, Jessica. Glad to be here.
Let's get started talking about you first. Walt, are you a mechanic?
No, I'm not a mechanic. Most of the people that I encounter do not require a mechanic either. I'd say maybe 10% of folks I encounter need a mechanic, but most do not.
How long have you been doing this for people?
I started it back about 1980 when I found a lady who had her hood is up and she needed a jump because her engine is stalled and her battery was weak, and so I gave her a jump with my cables, and that's when I started the whole thing.
So you just realized this was something you wanted to continue doing after that?
Well, I realized two things hit me after I gave her that jump. I said it was Christmas season, 1980s when it was, and two things hit me. One was how relieved she was at having been put back on the road, and the other thing was how good it made me feel. And so I began to, I said, well, I've got to do this more often. That really felt good. And so I began looking for vehicles that were in distress. And I quickly discovered that the kinds of distress were much more than just needing a jump. And so I needed to acquire some more skills and some more gadgets to do it. And over time, I did that.
So you've been doing this for more than 30 years now. You must have some crazy stories. What's the most memorable rescue you've made?
Oh, there's so many. And there are literally hundreds of memorable ones. One of them was, you know, I was in the Army for 23 years, and I realized that the Marine Corps, all the services, has the most service pride, even more than the Army does. I have to admit that. But one time I encountered a Marine out on Interstate 85 at 9:30 at night. He had his wife in the car, and his car had a flat tire. And the problem was he didn't have a jack, or his jack was broken. So it was 9 o'clock at night now. It was late, dark, and it was on an isolated stretch of highway. And so I pulled over and fixed the tire. I fixed the spare tire, no problem. Then we got to talking, and we were standing between our two cars. And he looked at me and he said, "Oh, I was really concerned as you stopped here because, I mean, we're right in the middle of no place out here. It's dark." He said, "And then I saw the Purple Heart license plates on your car when you backed up closer when my headlights shone on it." And he said, "I knew I was good to go then." So, and then we talked about the military. He said he'd been a Marine. But, you know, once a Marine, always a Marine. A lot of pride in that. And he talked about wanting to continue to drive that. And I said, you know, my advice is to go to the first motel, pull over, and wait till the morning, and then replace that flat tire with a good tire, and then continue your drive. And so we said goodbye, and I gave him a card. But the funniest part of the story, though, is a week later or so, I got a note in the mail, a thank you note, where he said, again, thank you very much for stopping. You really kind of saved my bacon that night. He said, and I never thought I'd say this, but go Army.
Well, if you're just tuning in, my guest is Walt Brinker. He is the author of Roadside Survival: Low-Tech Solutions to Automobile Breakdown. So let's talk about some of those solutions. Walt, what is the most common type of problem that causes breakdowns?
The most common problem, 3/4 of people I stop for have tire-related issues. They've got a blowout, tread has come off their tire, or the tire is just flat. And the complicating factors come in when they're not prepared to handle it. They don't have a spare tire. The spare tire they have is flat, which is the case 80% of the time. Or the spare tire has been swapped out with another car, and so it won't fit on their car. There are about 25 or 30 little subroutines like this that come in once, or that don't have the right jack. The jack is broken. They're missing components to the jack. They tried to jack the car up, and it was on soft ground. They have to put the parking brake on, so the car rolled once it was jacked up. Well, they tried to jack it up on soft ground, and the jack sunk into the sand, or the dirt, the wet dirt. There are lots of reasons like that why if you're not prepared and are not aware of these things ahead of time and don't prepare for them and get a few goodies to protect yourself or empower yourself to handle it, these things, you can get in big trouble. And that's what the book's all about. And also, the thrust, though, is to prevent breakdowns in the first place. Like, how can you check your tires to be sure they're in good shape? You don't want to drive on old tires. 6 years old is about as old as you want to be driving on a tire, because rubber ages. And I mean, a tire that's never been used, spare tire or regular tire, if it's never been used, the 6 years, it's a candidate for a blowout. You can determine the age of your tire very easily by looking at the DOT number on the sidewall. It's the last cluster of four tells you the age of the tire. Let's say it's 2003. That means the tire was made in the 20th week of 2003. You can quickly figure out how old it is.
Now, I want to ask you, you say in your book that your car often tells you when it's headed for a breakdown. So what are some of the signs we should watch out for in our cars?
Oh, yeah. Your car will talk to you. It'll tell you when it's about to fail on you. Your job is to listen and pay attention and then respond. You're driving along and you feel that the car's pulling to one side, or that the steering is mushy, or you go left, right, and the car kind of yaws too much. There's too much play in the suspension. That tells you that you have at least one low tire, because a low tire has more resistance and it'll drag the car to one side or the other based on what side the low tire's on. You want to keep an eye on the temperature gauge on the dashboard to see if it registers high, or if you smell steam, or you have any kind of steam coming out of your hood. But the trick is there. Get it to a shop now and get that fixed. Don't wait till you're caught out on the freeway, because then you got to pay for a wrecker. You don't know who to take it to, because you may be someone that you're not familiar with and don't know who the mechanics are to best take care of your car at a good rate.
And one last question for you, Walt. Any final tips to make sure drivers are ready for anything when they're going out on a road trip?
The biggest single thing, as I said before, is check your tires. The most important single thing of all is the quality and the status of the tires on the ground, that are on the wheels of your car. If those tires are in good shape, and the advice is buy new tires, don't buy used tires, because used tires are you're inheriting somebody else's time bomb in many cases. But and take the tires back every 5,000 miles. Buy a program when you buy the new tires that you can come back in and have them balanced and inspected and checked for wear and spin balance them and everything every 5,000 miles. That's a very worthwhile investment.
And you say tires are responsible for 75% of the breakdowns you've seen, right?
That's right. Easily 75%. They're tire-related problems. You know, that if people had the right tools, they could probably fix it or put the spare tire on the spot. But then they got to have air in the spare tire, you know. They need the jack that works. They need to be sure they have something to put under the jack if the ground is wet, et cetera, et cetera. And so there's more to this than just tires, but tires is by far the biggest single area. Another thing is running out of gas. I mean, people push it all the time, and they'll try it more and more miles on a tank of gas, or they'll ignore their gas gauge, or the gas tank gauge may be broken. If the gas gauge is broken, get it fixed. That ought to be fundamental. But until that time comes, you can always estimate what you have left by punching your odometer each time you buy gas and getting an idea of the miles per gallon you get out of a tank of gas and judging from there.
Okay. Thank you, Walt Brinker, for joining the program this morning.
Hopefully it helps the drivers who are listening today, because that's what I like to do is prevent breakdowns.
Hopefully it does. My guest is Walt Brinker, author of the book Roadside Survival, Low-Tech Solutions to Automobile Breakdowns. For more information from Walt, check out roadsidesurvival.com. More coming up on First Coast Connect straight ahead after this.
Hi, I'm Ray Hollister.
I'm Tom Braun.
And we're the guys from Deemable Tech.
Hey, if you've got a question about your computer, mobile phone, tablet, or the internet...
And who doesn't?
We're here to help.
Join us Thursdays during Morning Edition and All Things Considered here on WJCT.
And check out our podcast online at deemable.com.
That's deemable.com.
And welcome back. I'm Jessica Palumbo, and finally on First Coast Connect, we're celebrating the first quarter winner of our arts contest, The Square. It's a collaboration between WJCT and the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville. The inaugural round got over 120 submissions, and here to talk about his winning entry now is James English. He wrote the song Dandelion for the band Mortimer Rex. Welcome to First Coast Connect, James.
Thanks.
And
nice
congratulations.
To be here. Thank you.
In a minute, we're going to play your song. But first, I want to ask you, what is it about this song, Dandelion, that you think connected with so many voters?
You know, I chose this song from the list that we've
recorded, because it's probably the most universal of them. It's probably the most accessible.
Why?
It's this song is about regrets, living a life for somebody else and getting to a certain point and realizing that probably wasn't the best strategy. Probably should have gone with your first impulse on it. So that's what this song's about.
So who's the main character in this song?
That's a good question. There's two characters, a guy and a girl, as a lot of pop songs have. And I don't really know whose perspective it's from. It's either the guy or the girl, I guess. It's really about both of them, so it's not a first person. But it's about both of them growing up thinking that they were going to be together, and turns out that they did what was expected of them. One of them went to college, one of them went and started a career, and they lost paths, and you know, it's a pretty straightforward story, but it's kind of poignant.
So what are they regretting?
Specifically, they were regretting not being together, that they took diverging paths, and they hook up at some point in time later on, and they're both quote-unquote successful, but they realize what they lost in going those divergent paths.
So not a happy ending necessarily. You don't picture these two ending up together.
Let me tell you, happy songs with a happy ending are harder to write.
Yeah?
It's easier to write about love gone wrong or, you know, fighting the man or whatever. It's hard to write a happy song, so I have very few.
When you were writing this song, was there someone, the one that got away, maybe, that you were thinking about?
No, you know, my wife wants to know that question too. I have to tell you, it's not autobiographical. None of my songs are exactly autobiographical.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, there are little pieces of truth in there, whether it's from my life or people that I've seen or just kind of the universal experience. So no, I will absolutely emphatically say that this is not about me.
Now, is there sort of a common thread in your songs where you're writing about kind of a story about a character like this?
You know, I write a lot of songs and they come in two groups. One that I play with more of a alt country band that are not as direct, and this whole suite of songs that this song came from, they're story songs. It's I started out writing in college short stories, moved into poetry, and tried a novel, got about halfway through and realized that's just too much effort, so I started playing guitar and singing a little bit, and so the kind of songs I write are really a combination of all of that. They're all stories. They rhyme, so there's a little poetry in there. You know, you have to kind of do that with a song. But it's all a story, and so they're characters. One of the things that I found early on was that the more specific you can get about the situation that your characters are going through, the more universal it becomes. And so, you know, when I was 18, and I wanted to grasp something huge like love, I thought you had to talk about it broadly. And you know, you get a little better and a little older, and you write some. And I have found that the more specific you can be, the more universal.
Yeah. Those details kind of reminds me of Joni Mitchell's songs.
So I think the songs that I have, they're stories. It's a snapshot of somebody in time. There's something that came before it. There's something going to come after it, but right here at this moment. And there's a lot of imagery in the stories. It's a lot of pictures.
Now, James, can people go out in Jacksonville or in this area and hear you play?
They could if they invited me to. I'm not a professional musician.
Okay.
So this is, in fact, one of the things that this contest did was gave me an opportunity to put some music out there. The guys that are playing with me on this track actually live in North Carolina, so I could certainly do some shows, but it would just be me and a guitar. So the song that won, it's not me singing, actually. I'm playing guitar. Okay. On some parts of it.
Well, we're going to hear that in just a moment. James
Good.
English is the first ever winner of The Square, the local artist competition put on by WJCT and the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville. Submissions are now being accepted in round two of the contest on our website, by the way. Thank you so much, James English.
Thank you very much.
That is our program. Thank you to all of our guests and all of our callers and commenters. The show's producer is Sean Birch. The show's theme song is composed and performed by Pyotr Chevchik. Have any questions or comments about First Coast Connect? Send us an email at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to catch all of our daily podcasts there up on iTunes. Next on the Diane Rehm Show, Republican lawmakers unveil their budget proposals for 2016. Ideas include partially privatizing Medicare, repealing the Affordable Care Act, and increasing military spending. Diane and her guests discuss spending priorities for the Republican-controlled Congress. That's next. I'm Jessica Palumbo, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 tomorrow with Jacksonville mayoral candidate Omega Allen. And now we close with the music of Mortimer Rex and the song Dandelion by James English.
Grew up together since the summer when they both turned three. When a mama and daddy moved into the house across the street. They were always together at school and at church every week. They promised each other and exchanged some dandelion rings. He went to the city, she went to the university, so they could become the people that they're supposed to be. She lost her religion, and he lost his naivety. But these things don't weigh much, and they never noticed them leave. There's not always a price you can pay to get back what you lost yesterday. But if it spirals around, what's lost can't be found. Life's kind of funny that way. Time zone of distance put a decade or more in between. When they met up for dinner, it felt like it'd been just a week.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.